And we're going to begin our second class of the What is My Dharma series. Like a lot of you, I've been really powerfully struck by the correspondence on the listserv, by your sharings and by your personal emails. And part of what I think is clear here is that this is an ongoing inquiry that's very profound for a lot of us, whatever form it takes. And the question, what is my dharma, is always presenting itself to us. It presents itself, as we were seeing this week, as an overarching question about our life's purpose, but it also presents itself as a moment-to-moment question as to what the right choice is, what the right action is. And what we've been finding, and what has been really fascinating to me, is to see how asking this question actually brings up a whole trail of other issues. You know, it's kind of the long tail of the question, what is my dharma? Because what we're really looking at here is, how do we find a compass for our lives? How do we actually follow the guidance that wants to show itself to us in our lives? A couple of things that I wanted to note is that sometimes we have an expectation about what our dharma should be, and that can make it difficult to get to the depth of what wants to come up. Often, as someone said, that it's supposed to be something grand and glamorous or something public or even something different than what we're already doing. And another reason that it can be hard to get to the question is resistance, deprecation, self-doubt. Something often will come up, as has for a couple of people, that wants to be dealt with, that insists on being dealt with before the overarching what is my dharma question can be dealt with. And again, it's very skillful to realize that when one of these issues comes up, it's actually an opportunity to see it, to notice it, and to deal with it. In fact, my experience has been that when a resistance or when a question that comes up when we're trying to ask ourselves one of the great questions of life, that thing that comes up is often the thing that comes up over and over again in our lives, because it has to do with an underlying belief, an underlying small self, false self, misunderstanding about ourselves that we may have brought in from our parents, or that may be the result of the ways in which we have, in one way or another, not been willing to stand in our dharma in our life. So looking at the resistances that come up is actually very helpful for a number of reasons. The point being that asking this question is always a good idea. Either it'll put you face to face with what your soul really wants for you at this moment, or it'll put you face to face with the things that stand in the way of your living your soul's code. So we've been looking at dharma from the angle of purpose. What is our purpose? What is our swadharma? Later today, we're going to look at dharma as ethics, as right choice, if you will, as the moment-to-moment right path. And first, we're going to practice our opening chant, summoning the inner self, the inner teacher, the guide that that stands within us and constantly guides us towards our dharma. It always wants us to tune into our dharma. We'll be chanting with the invocation from Krishna Das, and then we'll be offering our meditation, our practice, our discourse this evening. And I would also like to ask you, if you're on a cell phone or on Skype, that if there's a way that you can mute yourself so that the ambient sounds don't come in, that would be great. So find yourself a comfortable posture, upright, grounding through the sitting bones. Feel the breath lifting up through the center of the body, up through the crown of the head. Let your chest lift and open. feel that you're fully present here, letting go of whatever threads of attention are in other parts of your day. If you need your paper, please have it handy. And we'll chant, asking for the presence of that ever-present awareness filled with consciousness, beingness, and blissfulness, which is our inner self. We ask that by the power of our practice, all beings may have happiness and the causes of happiness. We ask that all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. We ask that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. We ask that all beings experience equanimity beyond grasping, hatred, and ignorance. And we ask to know the equality of all beings. And you can bring your awareness to the breath, having a sense of this, the presence of this subtle flame in your heart, almond-shaped, golden. Again, it's not necessary to see it or to feel its heat, simply to recognize that it's there, because that flame is actually present in the heart. It's a genuine presence in the subtle body. And as you have the intention to be present with it, you invoke that flame to reveal its qualities to you. And as the breath flows in and out, breathe in with the feeling that you're actually inhaling the entire space in front of you. And with the exhalation, you breathe it out. Inhale, feeling the entire space behind you. And with the exhalation, breathe it out. Inhale, breathing in the entire sphere to your right. Just letting your body open up to take in the whole space to your right, and then with the exhalation, breathe it out. And now to the left. Inhaling the space to the left of you. And exhaling, breathe it out. Now inhaling the space below you, the earth beneath you, and exhaling, breathing it out. And inhale, breathing in the entire space above you. Breathing it into your body through the crown and breathing it back out. Now with the inhalation, feel that you're breathing in the space on all sides and above and below. You're exchanging with the breath the molecules of your body with the molecules of the air, harmonizing your inner body with the energy surrounding you. And as you inhale, you can feel that you're taking in as much of the space around you as you can, even into the vastness of space. And as you exhale, you breathe it back out. Welcome again, and especially welcome into the vortex of this community, this we space that we all inhabit together. We're going to continue this evening with a myth, with a story that's very germane to our purpose. But what I would like to ask you, and I'll send this to you in an email, is that if you have come up with a Dharma statement, with a soul code statement, that feels like it's at least provisionally something that you can work with, practice with, what I'd like to ask you to do is to send me an email with your Dharma statement on it, and then I can take them and put them together and send out a single email with everybody's Dharma statement, everyone who's willing to share, and that way we won't have so many emails coming into your listserv, but we'll all get to share what each of us is coming up with. So, the myth, the story. This is a myth from Plato's Republic, and it's actually a beautiful Western statement about what it is to follow Dharma lifetime after lifetime. You know, in the Western esoteric traditions, there's an understanding that the soul chooses a life according to the lessons that need to be learned. This is not quite so explicit in the Eastern tradition, although it's very much implied. So the understanding about Swadharma is actually based on an underlying recognition of the fact that we don't just live one life. It's not necessary to fully accept that in order to live with the idea of Swadharma, but the idea, the recognition that you actually, the game isn't over in this lifetime, seems to be one that's both comforting and also actually gives us a kind of depth and recognition of the importance and significance of our practice and our understanding. So this myth, this story is called the Myth of Ur. And like all myths, it speaks to us on a symbolic, imaginal level. It actually is a teaching for the soul. And the story goes that there's a soldier from the Trojan War who actually dies many years later in his bed. And when he dies, because of he's been so true to his dharma, he's given a boon that he can go to the land of the dead, see everything that's there, and actually remember the story. So he's given this tour on his deathbed, and he's able, the myth goes, to narrate it to somebody who's there with him. And in his tour of the land of the dead, he sees the souls of many great warriors and heroes and statesmen and tyrants of ancient Greece, some of whom will be familiar to us and some of whose names we wouldn't recognize. He speaks to many of them, he hears their stories, and then he's conducted to the place where souls get to choose their next life. And that place is on the banks of the river Letha, which literally means forgetfulness. It's the river that separates the world of the living from the world of the dead, or the visible from the invisible realms. And on these banks, he sees piles, and looking at them more closely, he realizes that they're the blueprints for different lives, different destinies. And he also sees that there are a number of souls who are now about to choose their next lifetime, their next destiny. And among them, there are many, many, many ordinary souls, ordinary people. But he also recognizes some famous beings, some statesmen, some tyrants, including some of the heroes like Odysseus, the great wise hero of the Trojan War. So the souls then draw lots as to who gets first pick, and they begin to choose the life that they're going to inhabit. And what we see is that the people who've had very eventful lives, lives in which they've actually had the possibility of hurting people or of making serious mistakes or causing wars or, in some way having an influence on the greater world that was not fully for the good, or simply who are tired of having such an active life, they tend to choose very obscure, quiet lives. And the people whose lives have been very obscure tend to choose more exciting lives. So in a very natural way, they're choosing to balance their destiny and also to take on challenges and dharmas that are the appropriate next stage for their soul's learning. And then the story goes, each soul goes before the fates, who are demigoddesses in the Greek tradition, who actually set the events of life in motion. And each soul goes with a daimon, that is to say, a divine being, a divine spark, who's actually the guardian of his life and the fulfiller of his destiny. So the daimon in the Greek tradition is that aspect of us, that spark within us, which guides us on the field of our destiny. And, you know, once they've been through this process, the souls are cast into the river of forgetfulness and go into their next lives, having lost all memory of the choosing. So Plato was a deep initiate in one of the Western esoteric traditions, and this story, of course, is meant to reveal to us the invisible agreements that we make between lives, the intentions that we had for ourselves. And it's interesting to notice that the Greeks took, as like the ancient Hebrews, and indeed the early Christians, took reincarnation for granted. And in fact, these days, there have been a number of studies, specifically studies done by a man named Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia, that turned up with some remarkable evidence for the possibility of reincarnation. Stevenson studied about 2,500 children between the ages of 3 and 7, and he found that a number of them remembered details of past lives and were able to identify where they lived, who the people they knew were, and many of these details were actually corroborated, by visiting those places and finding out that these children remembered things about a place they had never been in this life that they couldn't have known in any other way. In fact, some of them had birthmarks or birth defects that mirrored fatal wounds in the deceased or physiological weaknesses that mirrored their what they died of in the past. So this research, although it hasn't been accepted as fully conclusive, was impressed several reputable scientists, including Carl Sagan, enough so that they acknowledged that it was worthy of further study. So reincarnation is not just a belief system or a metaphysical idea. It's actually a very real possibility. And the story of Ur, besides being a tale of reincarnation, also suggests what Swadharma is about. It most tellingly, it points out that we choose the karmic situation that we'll live out. So even though the Eastern traditions don't place as much emphasis on choice as the Western traditions do, given their emphasis is on living the karmic hand that you're dealt in any given lifetime, nonetheless, choice is a powerful and significant part of our understanding of our soul's purpose. So the truth that's in both these stories that's I think very significant in our understanding about Swadharma is that our karma, our life situations, are given. Because of our actions and choices in the past, there are certain circumstances that we've chosen to live through in this lifetime. And at the same time, the understanding is that we do indeed have a unique soul blueprint, which in Sanskrit is called the mark of the jiva, the individual soul that we carry with us lifetime after lifetime, that intends to grow into its fullest expression of the unique being that we really are. The unique being that we are in a way that transcends the karmas of this lifetime. And yet, as Krishna says to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, it's our ability to live the life circumstances that we've chosen or been given that actually allow us to unfold our deeper being, because these life circumstances always contain the challenges and the lessons that we're meant to look at, that we're meant to work with. So actually one of the reasons that I've asked you to write eulogies is for different reasons that Stephen Covey asks people to write eulogies. It's not so much that you'll see your goals as that you'll begin to see by looking at your life backwards, and especially by giving the ideal circumstances of your life, you'll be able to see what it is that your soul intended for yourself, what it is that your Swadharma, your deep soul code, happened to be. So that's the overarching understanding of Swadharma. And at the same time, the understanding of Swadharma that is equally important is to realize that our dharma, our dharmic path, is going to unfold differently at different times in our life. So according to our life stage, and you know, as Krishna so eloquently says to Arjuna in the Gita, according to the ethics of our circumstances and the social forces that we are both culturally and in a family way involved with, the demands of our dharma are going to be different. And yet, this being the case, and again, this is the crucial understanding at the heart of the Gita, our ultimate swadharma is to know ourselves, to evolve, to recognize that our consciousness is identical with the Supreme Consciousness. And the experiences and the decisions and the choices that we make in this life have meaning not only because of how they play out in the game that we're playing, because the deep understanding of texts like the Gita is that life, with all its horrors and all its difficulties, is actually an arena, a stage, a kind of game that the Supreme Self is playing with itself in all our different forms. That the purpose of our many different destinies is to learn how to recognize the self, the deep consciousness, the evolving consciousness, that is our true being. You know, in certain contemporary evolutionary theories, the approach to evolution that comes through Aurobindo and Teilhard de Chardin, and that extraordinarily poetic and beautiful soul Thomas Berry, is that the universe consciousness is evolving itself through each one of us. That we in our being are the expression of evolving consciousness. So the acorn, the seed of our Swadharma, is not only ours, although it is utterly ours, our personal, unique expression. It's also the expression of the evolution of consciousness itself. So in a certain sense, our dharma, our responsibility, is always both to the evolution of our individual, unique soul journey, and also to the evolution of consciousness, which is constantly moving through us. So the Bhagavad Gita really holds this understanding, and it's the teaching of the Gita, of Krishna's teaching to Arjuna, is essentially a teaching on how you can live an active life in contact with your true self, with your true consciousness. I attended last weekend a gathering in which the question was asked, what does it mean to be an evolutionary activist and an agent of cultural change? And about half the people who were there were spiritual seekers, people who are very deeply committed to interior practice, whose purpose in life is liberation in a very personal way. And the others were people who believed that the most important thing in life is justice and social change. And there were a lot of overlaps, actually. There's hardly anybody in the room who wasn't doing some spiritual practice, and there was hardly anybody in the room who didn't understand that justice and social change are intrinsic to, you know, evolutionary activism. But at a certain point, you could feel that the committed activists had a feeling of impatience towards the more overtly spiritual types. You know, maybe they were thinking, you know, these people are kind of banging on about philosophy and higher consciousness when people are starving and there's, you know, there's tremendous injustice in the world that's not being addressed, and that the more philosophical types were in some way thinking these activists, you know, they're not seeing the forest for the trees. They're not necessarily realizing that true social change has to start with a vision that reaches back into our source of spirit. And what the Gita offers us is a vision that brings both of these positions together. It shows us how to live the life we are given, to fulfill our purpose, to in every way do what needs to be done in order to advance society and to fit into the imperatives of our culture and our social order in a way that helps move them towards higher consciousness, towards the greater expansion of the highest dharma. And yet it constantly turns us to the recognition that to live dharmically requires that we practice yoga. That is, that we practice constantly connecting ourselves to the truth, to the self, to the higher self, to the true self. And Krishna will give Arjuna a number of methods for doing this, one of them being meditation, another being something that we're going to speak about more fully in our third class, another being the practice of non-attachment or of doing one's actions, both for the sake of the action itself and also as an offering. But what Krishna says to Arjuna at the very beginning of his teaching is that yoga is skill in action. Yoga is skill in action. Yoga is the recognition that the dharma we are given, when pursued with skill, with the appropriate skill, and we'll get into what that is in itself yoga. I mean, you'll remember, of course, that Arjuna doesn't want to do his dharma. He doesn't want to fight a war that's going to involve terrible loss of life and destruction of his family. And when Krishna begins his teaching, he actually gives him a series of reasons why he has to fight. One of them is kind of pragmatic. You know, he points out that death is inevitable, that everyone who is born will eventually die. So the fact is that if you don't kill these people, somebody else is going to kill them. Secondly, he points out that it's impossible not to act in the world. And this is something very profound, because from a non-dual point of view, living our lives in these bodies is actually not something that we, at this point, have choice about. You know, our hearts beat, we get hungry, we get thirsty, something impels us to turn over in bed and ultimately to get out of bed, to interact with those people who are part of our lives, to earn a living. And we do it, he goes on to say, through expressing the gifts and talents that go with our nature. In other words, no matter how much you wish you had a beautiful voice, or I'll say what I really mean, which is that no matter how much I wish I had a beautiful singing voice, the fact is that I don't, and no amount of singing lessons are going to give me one, and believe me, I've tried. But on the other hand, I have skill as a writer, and so my dharma does involve some form of communication. And you know, many of you have skill at organization. You might have skill at certain kinds of strategy or at taking care of money. And, of course, as Krishna tells Arjuna, the exercise of these skills is utterly necessary for the well-being of society. And more to the point, if you don't exercise these skills, your life is going to stop working. In other words, everything in your life will go sour on you at one time or another. sooner rather than later if you're not fulfilling your purpose. But Krishna isn't telling Arjuna to fight just for the sake of his social duty. He's, you know, because the fact is, if you're trying to act dharmically, you don't determine actions out of social duty, nor do you determine actions simply in order to feel better about yourself. The fact is that the social forms in which you find yourself are the way in which you express your dharmic path, in which you make the choices that are going to lead to your evolution, because you have to act within the forms that you've been given. And that can mean doing a job that you don't enjoy anymore because you have to earn a living. It can mean having to make very difficult choices and decisions, you know, decisions when we're kind of between a rock and a hard place, which is the choice that Arjuna is facing. He's literally between a rock and a hard place, faced with killing people he loves, yet knowing the war has to be fought. So if you consider a time in your life when you face such a choice, and for many of us this is a matter of ethical choice, but often it can be just something that life throws up at you. For example, you know, to make a living, you have to be away from your children. Most people have to be away from their children, and yet being away from your children, especially when they're young, causes pain. Causes pain to you and causes pain to your children. So what do you do? It's how do you make the choice? It's a rock and a hard place. You know, or perhaps you're deeply committed to social action, but because of the politics of the situation, you may have to compromise something that feels very important to you in order to be effective. So what do? Or your marriage is at an impasse, but to end it means uprooting your entire way of life. So what do? Someone you love has hurt you, and you're really angry. How do you respond? What do? So in many of these situations, a useful way to walk through difficult choices through your dharmic path is to ask yourself, moment by moment, what's the next right thing to do? What's the next right thing to do? It's a very good mantra, dharmic mantra. It's a good way to proceed when your life feels overwhelming or when you're in emotional turmoil. You know, when I can say from my own experience that once you have a sense of what your deeper swadharma might be, of what your overriding purpose might be, this question becomes a lot easier to answer. In other words, you're able to answer it partly by considering whether your action is in line with your larger purpose. But to ask the question, what's the next right thing to do, and get a really useful answer, it's absolutely necessary to clear your mind. You need to be able to hear the thread of Dharma, to hear what the right thing to do is, because let's face it, we all have tendencies which tend to cloud the issues. Sometimes the issue is that we have a very strong agenda or a desire that we're pushing so hard that we're just not able to hear that there might be a deeper truth that wants to be expressed. We might have an outcome that we're very attached to, which is, of course, one reason why Krishna, right at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, counsels acting without attachment. We'll get into that later. But sometimes the issue is self-doubt or unsureness, you know, or ambivalence. So, you know, this kind of constant self-questioning, you start down a particular path, you ask yourself, what's the right thing to do? What's the next right thing? And an answer comes and you say, is that really right? Did I really think that? Or is that just my mind? Or maybe this is bullshit. And this kind of doubt is ultimately paralyzing. In fact, at one point in the Gita, Krishna says to Arjuna that when it comes to choosing your life path and when it comes to the practice of yoga, someone who doubts cannot follow the path. We're not talking here about effective, productive questioning. We're talking about this tendency in us to doubt the rightness of what we're doing. I had a friend years ago who was a yoga teacher, and one of her students called her one day and she said, "You know, I've noticed that my philodendron isn't doing so well." And she said, "I'm really worried. I think maybe there's something in my vibration that's killing the plant. And, you know, maybe the plant's telling me that you know, the way I'm living is out of tune with life. I mean, maybe my whole life is wrong if my plant is dying. You know, maybe I shouldn't be with this guy that I've been dating. Maybe he's the reason." And her yoga teacher said, "So how long since you've watered the plant?" And the young woman thought about it, and then she said, "Well, actually, she hadn't really given the plant any water in about 3 weeks. You know, it's a philodendron. They're kind of hardy." And then as soon as she realized that she hadn't been watering the plant, she started to beat herself up. She said, "Oh, my God, what kind of person am I? I've neglected my plant. You know, it's a sign. It's what I do with my whole life." The yoga teacher said, "Forget the analysis. Go water the plant." And, you know, of course, when you hear this story, you kind of know the outcome. And the fact is that very few of us let our doubts paralyze us that much, at least not most of the time. But the point is that hearing our Dharma, finding out what the next right thing is, necessitates our getting our minds clear enough so that we can see past our egoic agendas and our paralysis. And even if the answer we get isn't the ultimate answer, that answer is going to lead you to an action and another action and the possibility of correction, course correction, and eventually you'll find that you're actually traveling a real intuitive dharmic path. So this is why Krishna insists that Arjuna practice meditation, because focusing and stilling the mind, the focus and stilling of the mind from that comes from meditation, is what is going to allow us the clarity that will ultimately make it possible to answer the questions of Dharma. So one of the purposes of meditation, which the Yoga Sutras and the Bhagavad Gita tell us, is steadiness of mind, actually being able to make the mind, as in Krishna's words, as steady as a lap in a windless place. And this is something that takes a lot of practice. It asks us for a very deep meditative discipline. But as Krishna again says, even a little of this practice is going to make a big difference, and the accumulation of it will eventually clear away the fog from the mind so that we are actually able to really, really hear, really discern the voice of Dharma. So, of course, the next right thing is that we meditate. And once again, you can bring yourself into a comfortable upright posture. Breathing in, feel that the hips and thighs and sitting bones become heavy and sink into the seat, really melt into the seat. And then as you exhale, with your attention fully in your body, feel that the breath flows up through the center of the body and draws up the spinal column up through the crown. Inhale and let the shoulder blades release onto the back. Exhale and let the chest lift and open. And this time, we're going to do a meditation practice that is specifically designed for clarity of mind. It's a very precise, concentrative practice. And I want to say to you that what's important is not so much being able to achieve the visualization. It's really what's important is actually being able to experience the inner center that we'll be meditating with and bring the mind gently into a state of a little bit more focus. So our attention now is in the third eye center, just a above the upper palate, in the very center of the head. And as you inhale, you feel that the breath flows in to this, flows in and touches the center of the head. And as you exhale, the breath flows out through the crown. And then you inhale through the crown into this place in the center of the head, and exhale through the center of the forehead. Inhale now through the center of the forehead, letting the inhalation touch this place in the very center of the head. And as you do, feel that this almond-shaped flame, this golden flame, is there in the center of the head. So as you inhale into the flame, the inhalation allows the flame to glow a little bit more. And as you exhale, with the feeling that the breath flows out through the crown, your attention is on the flame. You breathe in through the crown, feeling the breath brightening the flame. The breath flows out through the forehead. But your attention is on the flame in the center of the head. So you're breathing in this L-shaped pattern, in through the forehead, touching the flame, out through the crown, in through the crown, touching the flame, out through the center of the forehead. If you lose track and it becomes too complicated, then just let the breath flow in and out through the center of the forehead. But keep your attention on this sense of the flame in the very center of the head. In the inner space, it's called the Ajna Chakra. The chakra, the center of the higher mind, whose place is right at the place of the pituitary gland, just above the upper palate. And that flame is a genuine, very profound vision that lives in this space, that one day as you meditate may very well reveal itself to you. And as the breath flows in and out and touches the flame, a flame in the center of the head, you feel that the flame is steady. It's as steady as a lamp in a windless place. The breath flows in, touches the flame, flows out from the flame. And you let your focus become steadier and steadier on that inner flame in the center of the head. And in this practice, you're polishing the clarity of your mind. You notice that what we've been doing in both these meditations is turning into a sense of this subtle almond-shaped flame within the heart and within the center of the head. And each of these flames, awareness of meditation on each of these flames. And again, it's not necessary to get a full visualization of it to begin to sense that they're there because they are there. And the more you practice with them, the more you'll begin to recognize that they're there. That these meditations with the flames are actually a way of giving us an entry point into two centers where the recognition of Dharma is able to become apparent. By clearing the mind with the flame in the center of the head, and by tuning into the center in the heart, we little by little begin to be able to ask these questions of ourselves and get answers which come from the light of the inner self, which is expressing itself in the form of these two flames. For some of us, the heart center is more of a portal to the knowledge of Dharma, to the wisdom of Dharma. For some of us, it's the center in the head. But as we begin to open these centers, we more and more find where we're led in our pursuit of deep understanding. So we're going to talk now about some of the ways that we can actually answer the question, what is my Dharma, in a day-to-day, moment-to-moment situations. In other words, we're going to get some criteria for how we know what the right thing to do is in situations where you find yourself at sea or in need of making a decision. We do need these yardsticks because they allow us measure. They allow us to measure ourselves against something or in relationship to something. And years ago, searching for clues on the path of correct action, I came across a formula that actually seems to me to be really, really helpful set of questions that you can ask to understand what Dharma is. It's a set of guidelines from one of the texts from the same tradition, the Upanishadic tradition of India that the Bhagavad Gita is from, and probably comes from the same period. It's called the Yajnavalkya Samhita. Yajnavalkya was a famous sage whose teachings appear in the Upanishads, which is the Upanishads being the record of the teachings of the forest sages to their disciples in India in around 1500 BC. And like most ancient wisdom, these teachings sometimes need a slight facelift in order to suit our contemporary conditions. But actually, once we've started to consider how we can apply them to our life, they become incredibly useful as really mirrors for our journey. So here they are. I'm going to give them to you all together at first, and then we'll look at them one by one. The sources of Dharma are known to be these. 1, the sacred texts, meaning the wisdom that the traditions have handed down to us about what it means to be a good person and to act dharmically. 2, the practices of the good, that is, the examples set by people who really live their Dharma in one way or another. 3, whatever is agreeable to one's own self, that is, what gives you joy and a sense of personal rightness, a sense of personal satisfaction. And 4, the resolve that has arisen out of a wholesome desire. The resolve that has arisen out of a wholesome desire. And then the passage goes on to give us a kind of dharmic bottom line. Over and above such acts as self-control, nonviolence, charity, and study of truth, which are some of the classic good practices that the yoga tradition gives us, this is the highest dharma, the realization of the self by means of yoga. So over and above all the acts that we do to practice dharma, to improve our character, to purify our mind, this is the highest dharma, the realization of the self by means of yoga. And the yoga that he's talking about is the fourfold yoga of meditation, self-inquiry, karma yoga, or dedicating our actions, and the yoga of devotion. So, and about of that more next week. What I really love about this prescription is that it's actually not absolutist. Instead of saying do this or do that, it gives you a method for weighting the different factors that are at stake in any important life path decision. So, and it's basic. You know, what it basically says is, here are some guidelines. Now figure out what to do. And I also want to say that this teaching takes it for granted that we are actually making an effort to follow the overall guidelines of a dharmically responsible life. In other words, it assumes that we're not completely at the mercy of our addictions, that we're taking responsibility for the way we use our energy, that we're doing our best to be good people, and considering the consequences of our actions, especially doing our very best not to harm ourselves or other living beings, to serve others. And so understanding that these guidelines are given to us as people really looking to live a path, the path of the good life, let's go through them one by one. So the first, of course, and this is really Dharma 101. When you're wondering what the right thing to do is, begin by checking in with the traditional wisdom. Even though in postmodernism we tend to distrust the traditional wisdom, that is the wisdom of a book like the Bhagavad Gita, because we think it comes out of a culture that is not as complex as our own. Yet the basic truth is that what the traditional wisdom points to, if we know how to apply it correctly, that is, if we know how to apply it without rigidly trying to apply it as though the conditions of contemporary life were the same as the conditions of, you know, rural agrarian India or rural agrarian Europe, yet the fact is that what these traditional wisdoms point to is what is eternal, what is unchanging, and what we can actually cling to. You know, dharma is what we cling to in order to have a path through the world. So, in the Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 16, Krishna gives some of the qualities that are the qualities of a person who is destined for liberation, a person who is really able to live the highest dharma, and they're qualities that you'll be familiar with. They include nonviolence, non-stealing, truth-telling, absence of anger, fearlessness, purity of heart, it's a long list, charity, renunciation, that is the ability to let go of things, peacefulness, absence of deceit, compassion, gentleness, modesty, vigor, forgiveness, fortitude, and equanimity. So one of the most powerful things you can do in order to educate yourself in dharma is, first of all, to read texts like the Bhagavad Gita, texts that have to do with dharma, with ethics that are eternal. But secondly, to just decide to take on one of these guidelines, one of these qualities, and actually work with it. See what it's like to hold it and practice it in your daily life. What you'll probably find, at least this is my experience, is that none of them are so easy, and yet simply trying to work with truthfulness or nonviolence or or fearlessness demands that you examine yourself, that you look at everything you do in the light of what it is that you're trying to do. And you find that these practices have a natural power that will transmit wisdom to you. In other words, just by trying to practice truthfulness or trying to practice gentleness or fortitude, you'll be naturally led to a sense of what your dharma is in a given moment. So suppose the teaching you're working with is equanimity, which is one of the really powerful values of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says to Arjuna in the very beginning, evenness of mind is yoga. Equanimity is yoga. And actually that even-mindedness is one of the requests that we make of the universe when we do our opening dedications. We ask that we have equanimity. So when you want to practice equanimity, you begin by spending some time thinking about what equanimity is, what it means. I'm actually going to give you that assignment this week, so you'll get to do it yourself. But, for example, you might ask yourself, what's the difference between equanimity and indifference? A lot of people believe that to be equanimous is not to care about anything. Or whether practicing equanimity means you never feel your emotions. So you ask yourself what equanimity means, and then once you have a sense of what it means, what you might want to do is actually look up the word equanimity in the dictionary. If you happen to have the Bhagavad Gita, read that. I'm going to send you a passage on equanimity that is very useful. But then you try to apply it, and you notice what the effects are. So you notice, for example, what thoughts help you feel even-minded. What does regular meditation do for your capacity for equanimity? What is yoga, or in fact, what are the activities that help you feel more equanimous? And what challenges your equanimity? That's a big one. How do you treat your own emotional ups and downs? Do you tend to give in to your feelings or to suppress them? What do you do when you want to regain your even-mindedness when you've lost it? So part of what we'll be doing this week is a practice called samyama. And we're going to do it for a few minutes now. Samyama means the discipline of making yourself one with something. So in this case, what we want to do is take the idea of equanimity into our consciousness and allow it to work in our consciousness almost like a mantra. So again, you can sit quietly. Those of you who have a very strong relationship to the Dharma tree, to the world tree, might like to take yourself to the world tree, to seat yourself in that place where you're in the presence of the great tree of Dharma and sit with your back against it, because the tree of Dharma is really the very quintessence of equanimity. And with your breath, now bring your awareness into the heart, which is the seat from which we practice samyama. And with the inhalation, offer the thought, equanimity, into the heart. See if you can hold equanimity. in your heart the thought of equanimity. What is it to be even-minded? And as you do this, there's a posture of the arms, a mudra, that you can take. If you have your hands free, and if not, you can do it later in the week. So you have the thought, equanimity, flowing in and out of your heart with the breath. And you're aware of your forearms. Your forearms are held in a very relaxed way with the elbow perpendicular to the shoulder, with the elbow really hanging from the shoulder. I'm sorry, your upper arms are held in this very relaxed way with the elbow in line with the shoulder. And your arm is bent so that your forearm is at a 90-degree angle to your very relaxed upper arm. And your palms are open. And you're holding both your hands this way, and you notice that when you have the right angle, you're able to hold your arms very relaxedly in this posture. And it's a posture of balance. It's a posture of natural equanimity. The weight of the elbow holds your forearm, your upper arm, in a very relaxed way. Your forearms are bent so that they're parallel with your thighs, and the palms are open. And you find the position of equanimity, the position where you can actually hold this posture with a sense of balance and ease. And in your heart, you hold this thought, equanimity. And you can bring your hands back down to your thighs or to your lap. Let go of the posture. But see if the sense that you get from practicing that position of the arms has given your body more of a sense of what it is to be in balance, to experience equanimity. Equanimity is the place where the opposites are in balance. The in-breath flows into the heart and pauses and then flows out. And in that place in the heart from which the breath arises and subsides, there is equanimity. It's the place between the in-breath and the out-breath. Equanimity is the place where you're poised between night and day, between wanting and not wanting, between acting and not acting. A place where you're poised between emotion and calm. Equanimity is the place where you can watch whatever arises and subsides in your own mind and your own emotional life and remain poised, remain balanced, remain not just the observer, but the observer who is completely held in the sense of presence that arises in the heart. So equanimity is the experience of being poised and balanced in the heart, like a flame in a windless place. So how does your energy feel when you hold this thought of equanimity? Not trying to figure it out, just feeling the energy that's shed into your consciousness with this thought, equanimity. Now imagine, how does equanimity move? How does equanimity speak if you are embodying equanimity? How do you speak? How do you move? Just let yourself imagine yourself with a heart filled with equanimity. The second yardstick for right action, for Dharma, for deciding what the next right thing is the practices of the good. And that really invites us to channel the discernment that we have received, often unconsciously, from observing people who consistently make dharmic ethical choices, or who follow their own swadharma, their own inner guidance. And of course we can do this in a very exalted way. It's a big practice in Christian sadhana to ask yourself, what would Jesus do? And for many social activists, the question is, what would Martin Luther King do, or what would Gandhi do? So what would these people who embodied nonviolent social action do under these circumstances? Or you could substitute your grandmother or a friend whom you think has very good dharmic judgment. I have several friends who I think are really masters of one particular area of life. So, for example, when I feel like I need to take a courageous, bold action that I'm having a little bit of trouble with, I'll often think, what will my friend Ruthie do? Because she's a person who has an incredible capacity for moving forth into life and doing great things for other people without hesitation and with a lot of skill and discernment. Or when I'm trying to connect with somebody that I wouldn't ordinarily feel drawn to, I'll often think, well, what would Mark do? My friend Mark is somebody who's really has a gift for loving people, no matter who they are, people whom nobody else notices or considers important. He's able to very easily and naturally and very lovingly connect to them. When I want to be caring with somebody, but in a non-wimpy way, I often think, what would my friend Karen do? She's a person who has enormous capacity for caring for people, but she never enables them. The question, what's the right thing to do, is very often if you ask yourself what someone that you respect in a certain area would do, you'll often get an immediate visceral answer, like an embodied answer. One of my friends actually asks the question, what would a mature person do in this circumstance? He feels that he has a good idea of what a mature person is. And of course, what happens when he asks that question is that he invokes his inner mature person. That person who's actually able to make choices based not on his immediate desires or fears, but on, you know, a real sense of what's good for the situation. So the third criteria is very interesting. It's whatever is agreeable to one's own self. Whatever is agreeable to one's own self. You know, you might know what the texts say is the right thing to do. You might have a sense of what a good person would do. But if something doesn't go with your nature, if it's not something that you can full-heartedly do with joy, then it may not be your dharma. And so asking that question, is this agreeable to me? Is this something that's natural to me? Is a very, very profound way of checking into what actions we can actually take, what right actions we can naturally take. For example, one example of how this works in terms of major life decisions is the decision to have children. You know, many of us, when we're at the life stage where our biology is primed to reproduce, feel that we should have children. And yet, very often there's something in us that doesn't really want children, or that likes children, you know, when we are with them for 10 minutes, but who really does not like everything that goes along with bringing up children. So sometimes we find ourselves in an inner war between our idea that having children is good, is important, that we should want a child, that it's good to bring up children, or perhaps our partner's desire to have a child, and our own inner feeling that we don't actually want to be a parent. And some of us do it anyway, overriding the feeling of resistance or fear. Sometimes circumstances just make it happen. And often we find that it's very hard to be really present with our children, even though we try to do our best for them, because something in it is not agreeable to us. And that said, you know, in circumstances like that, when you're in a situation that's not agreeable, when you have a dharma, a duty in the situation, then what you do is you learn how to make it agreeable to yourself. You know, you learn how to find the place in the activity where there's joy, and you know, in that sense, your duties and your responsibilities become the avenue for growth. You know, for the challenges of growth, so the question, whatever is agreeable to your own self, is an important question. It's not the only question. In fact, none of these questions are the only question. They're part of the ways that we understand what dharma is. You know, another example of what is agreeable has to do with our professional choices. You know, sometimes we go into a profession because it was your father's profession, or because it's prestigious, or because we can make money at it. But, you know, or we think it's a good thing to do, but we'll often find, if we look more deeply, that a part of us doesn't really enjoy what we're doing. It isn't agreeable to us. And this is going to very much affect our capacity to do that particular dharma. And that said, feeling wrong about a course of action can be hard to distinguish from resistance that comes up when you're asked to try something new and challenging. And in the same way, feeling right about it can be hard to distinguish from greed or desire, or from wanting something so badly that you'll overlook the warnings from your inner self. The truth is that our mind and our desires need to have been purified to some degree before we can fully trust our own feeling to tell us what's right and what's wrong. And that's, you know, so I'll say this again. The question of what is agreeable to ourselves is a question that really becomes a true criteria for dharma when our mind and heart have become somewhat purified, so that we know how to tell when the agreeableness of something is a sign that we should do it, and the disagreeableness a sign that we shouldn't. But the interesting thing about this criteria, and part of what makes it very important to us, is that it's telling us that doing the right thing is not supposed to be disagreeable. Sometimes it is. Sometimes the circumstances in which we find ourselves are not pleasant. But making a choice simply because it's disagreeable and we think that that makes it better is not necessarily dharmic. So the fourth criteria, the resolution that flows from a wholesome desire, actually cuts to the heart of our personal capacity for making dharmic choices. So what is a wholesome desire? It's a desire that actually connects you to union, to unity, to truth. And it can also be a desire that's helpful to the world, that actually furthers the evolution of consciousness. You know, that when you've begun to make a commitment to being an agent of the evolution of consciousness, then your desires begin to become desires that actually make it more and more possible for you to act as an agent of evolving consciousness. The word resolve in this sentence is actually a translation of the Sanskrit word sankalpa, which, you know, a sankalpa, the word, the syllable kalpa means a vow, an inner resolution. San means pure, means sacred. So a sankalpa is a conscious intention that comes from your recognition of what will help you live your most sacred life at this time, the life that is most in accord with your Swadharma. Without that resolve, Krishna says, our desires are, in his words, many-branched and endless. In other words, without that resolve, which comes from the wholesome desire, we're all over the place, and we can't really find our dharma. So one of the best ways to answer this, the inner question as to what is the right action for me, is to ask the question as, what is my most heartfelt desire? What do I really desire in my life right now? Your heartfelt desire might be different than it was 10 years ago, or what it will be a year from now. Your heartfelt desire might be very, very specific and personal, or it might be more general. But one of the ways to find your heartfelt desire is to look at a desire that's up for you at this moment. You know, for example, when I have a deadline, when I have a class to give or an article to write, my heartfelt desire, which overrides all my other desires, is to meet the deadline. It's completely amazing how a deadline and the desire to meet it will completely organize me so that, you know, my desire to space out or to read a novel or to talk on the phone or to go for a walk, all of these fall into place because the desire to meet the deadline is so strong. But when I ask myself, you know, when I use that desire to meet the deadline as a spur to finding out my deeper desire, then very often I can use that overriding immediate desire to take me to something deeper. And with the way you do it, and we're going to do it in a moment, is by asking yourself, what's your strongest desire at the moment? And then imagine that desire fulfilled. And then ask if there's something more you desire. And ask you to imagine that desire fulfilled. And you keep tracing it back until you actually find what's the deepest desire among all the desires that you may be holding at the moment. And then that deep desire then becomes a way that you can make a resolution or an intention that will, once again, keep you in line with your deeper dharma. So, as an example, this afternoon I asked my friend Linda what her deepest desire is at this moment, and she She said her deepest desire right now, what's on her mind, is to resolve an argument she's having with her daughter. You know, our immediate desire might be to do something, to achieve something, or to become free from something, an anxiety or a difficult situation. So I ask her to imagine that the desire is fulfilled, that she's resolved the argument with her daughter. And she does, and then immediately she says, okay. So feeling that desire has been fulfilled, is there another desire that's behind that desire that's present now? And that question takes her deeper. And she says that, you know, it's the desire for harmony. And I have a deeper desire for harmony. And I say, okay, what's behind that? She gets silent and she says, well, it's love. So that's an answer I think that comes up for many of us, especially when our desires are interpersonal. But so behind your most conscious desire, the desire that's on your mind at the moment, is another desire and a deeper desire. So I'd like to ask you now to close your eyes, and I'm going to ask you, at this moment, what's your desire? Or shall I say, at this point in your life, on this day, what's the desire that feels strongest to you? It might be the desire that you're holding at this particular life stage. It might be something more immediate, but just tune in to what your desire is right now. And now imagine that the desire has been fulfilled. And feel the way it feels to have that desire fulfilled. Now, is there a deeper desire? Something behind the initial desire, something that comes up even in the moment that you feel that your initial desire is fulfilled. Now imagine that desire is fulfilled. Now what's behind this desire? See if you can go deeper. Even in this moment of feeling, imagining that your desire is fulfilled, is there a deeper desire? See if you can keep imagining that a particular desire is fulfilled and then going to the deeper desire. And so in this moment, having gone through that little process, just ask yourself, what is my heartfelt desire at this moment? What is my heartfelt desire at this moment? And we're going to recognize that our heartfelt desire is actually a desire that comes from our Swadharma. And taking the steps to fulfill this heartfelt desire. Is actually going to help us unfold our Dharma in this life. So as we bring this evening together to a close, we're going to sit with the heartfelt desire. Focus your awareness on the breath. Allow the breath to flow in and flow out through the heart. Allow the breath to touch that inner flame, the pure almond-shaped flame. And have the feeling that now that you're offering your heartfelt desire, whether it's a desire that expresses itself in words or a desire that is simply felt as a longing, as a feeling, even as a recognition of something that's already present in your life. Offer that heartfelt desire into the flame in the heart with the inhalation. You offer your heartfelt desire into the source, which is your own heart. And with the exhalation, feel that your desire is fulfilled simply by expressing it, by offering it. It is already fulfilled. And allow yourself to feel in your body the experience of fulfilled desire. And with great love, I offer you the wish for a beautiful evening and a beautiful week. And we offer our practice and our contemplation, asking that everything that we've done and thought and said be of benefit to all beings and be an expression of the highest Dharma. Have a beautiful night. Namaste.